Hello and welcome to another Linguistics Career Cast, the podcast devoted to exploring careers for linguists outside academia. I'm your host, Laurel Sutton. Marta Baffi is a lawyer and linguist who has over a decade of English as a second language teaching experience, both in the United States and abroad. She received her PhD in linguistics from Georgetown University and her JD from the Cardozo School of Law. Her research focuses on the discourse processes underlying law student socialization to law school and the legal profession, as well as discourse analysis of interactions in the courtroom and congressional hearings. Marta's current position is Professor of the Practice and Director of Academic Success at University of Baltimore School of Law. Topics discussed include teaching English, law school, second language education, sociolinguistics, networking, LLM, or Master of Laws, forensic linguistics, and legal English. Links to Marta Baffi's LinkedIn profile and other resources are in the show notes. I would like to welcome Marta Baffi to our podcast today. Marta, thank you so much for joining us, and I am really eager to talk about your journey and then your experiences with linguistics and the law.
Thank you so much for having me.
So looking at your career, you have a lot of degrees. You have way more degrees than I do, which is great. So I am really interested to talk about how you got involved in linguistics and where you started from, which was with a BA in psychology, correct?
That's correct. Yeah. So I had wanted to be a psychologist, a therapist, a counseling mm-hmm. psychologist for a very long time. I think from the age of 11 or 12.
Wow.
And so that's what led me to psychology and to studying psychology in undergrad. And when I graduated, my plan was to continue with psychology, to go to grad school in Europe. So I'm originally Hungarian. So So I got into a school in Hungary to do my master's in psychology. And the summer before I was supposed to go, one day my mom just came to me and asked, "Are you sure this is what you want?" And that's really all it took to make me question, my decision. And I wasn't sure. And then I remember I took about a day or two to come up with a new plan. And I really thought about what is something that I've always been interested in. Mm-hmm. And what came to mind was teaching and teaching English. So because when I was 8 years old, that's when I moved to the United States with my family. So, I learned English at that time. I was in an ESL program for about a year, a little less than a year, an academic year. And then, I learned English, and then I joined the English classroom. Mm-hmm. And I loved pretending that I was an English teacher at that time. Yeah, so I played with my dolls all the time. And that's what I was thinking back to, on that day that my mom asked me that question. And I thought, I really want to go to Hungary. I already have my ticket. And I want to teach English. And I just want to try that out. And so I started researching certificate programs and private language schools where I could potentially teach English. And that's how I stumbled upon the CELTA, which you might have heard of already. That's the Certificate in English Language Teaching to Adults.
Mm-hmm.
And so I enrolled in that. I had my ticket to Hungary, so I enrolled in that in Budapest. I did it for a month, and then I got a job at a private language school.
Wow, that's quick.
Yeah, it was super. But I had to sell this idea to my parents, so I really just kind of cooked up this whole plan of, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to get this certificate, and then I'm going to teach in Hungary for a year, and during that time, I will study for the LSAT. Which is the exam to get into mm-hmm. law school in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I had never thought about law ever before this. It was just, I felt like it was the only way that I could sell this idea to my parents.
Okay.
So, and they liked it. They agreed with it. So they said, okay, great. You don't have to do this master's in psychology. It sounds like a great plan. And then, you know, you'll go to law school. And yeah, I had never really kind of thought through the whole law thing, but I thought I'll figure it out once I get to Hungary and start studying for the LSAT.
Honestly, what parent is going to say, no, I don't want you to be a lawyer, right?
Like... Right. And I knew that they would like that plan. You know, they are physicians and my sister is also a doctor. And so I was always the black sheep. And, you know, I felt like this was something that they would approve of. And they did. They liked the idea. So with that, I went to Hungary and I started teaching English and I just fell in love with it. You know, that first day that I taught in the CELTA program, you basically have to teach on day two. And it was a very short 30-minute lesson, but I just felt like it was the right place for me. Things just really clicked. And so I fell in love with teaching English. And then 1 year became 2 years. The LSAT kind of got put on the back burner. And then I decided to come back to the US to get a master's in linguistics.
Wow.
Yeah. And I really enjoyed that. So it was in applied linguistics. I really liked that program. I continued to teach English while I was taking classes. This was in New York City. And then while I was there, there was something about that plan to do law school that was still kind of gnawing at me. And I thought, okay, maybe I should give that a shot again as well. And then I applied to law school. I got in to a few schools. I chose one that I liked the most. And then I decided to go to law school.
Yeah. So, just to skip back for a second, how did you, like, did you know about linguistics as a discipline or did you get that through taking the classes that you were taking in Hungary?
I didn't know about it as a discipline. I wasn't taking any classes in Hungary because I didn't do my master's in psychology. So the whole time I was there, I really just taught English. And that's kind of how I started to learn a little bit more about language teaching. I was really interested in second language acquisition. SLA research that informs the pedagogy, right? And so I think we did learn about that a little bit, but it was a lot more practical, hands-on training, right? Just being in the classroom. I did learn a little bit about SLA in particular, and then I started doing more research about, again, SLA in particular, but linguistics as a discipline, and it was just something I was getting more and more interested in. And it's funny because I don't actually ever think about this very much anymore because this was literally 20 years ago. This was in 2004. 2004 to 2006 that I was in Hungary teaching English. But I was very interested in syntax and the acquisition of, you know, syntax, which is just funny to think about now because I'm not that interested in that anymore. I was doing research on this as a topic, and that's really what compelled me to apply to a linguistics program instead of law school and to come back to the US and do that.
That totally makes sense. And so when you started the master's program in linguistics, like, what were your goals at that time as you were entering the program?
It's hard for me to remember exactly. you know, a little bit. I think I was just kind of living in the moment a little bit. I knew that teaching was something that I just really, really loved. It felt like it was the right thing for me. And I feel that way to this day. I mean, just this August, I celebrated my 20-year teaching anniversary. And so that was what I was mostly focused on, is I wanted to teach English or just teach in some capacity. I think the long-term goal was the PhD in linguistics and to become a linguistics professor. But, you know, I'm not sure exactly what I envisioned at that time, but I I'm fairly certain that was the long-term goal.
Yeah. Okay. So you did that, you got your master's, but then you got back into law. So how did that happen?
Yeah. And of course, that had to happen while I was doing my master's, right? Because I applied to law programs in fall of my second year in the master's. So, and I think that came from kind of just this feeling that I didn't really, even though I came up with that plan on a whim, right, to apply to law school, I just couldn't let it go. And I really wanted to try that out. You know, I think there was a little bit of pressure from my parents as well, probably indirectly. You know, they never told me, you know, I should do that instead. But I think I felt that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I decided to take the LSAT, and I applied to law school, got into law schools. And as I said, I chose one and went there.
And I'm so curious right now, like, how did it feel going from a master's program in linguistics, like a classical academic type thing, to law school, which is still going to school, but it's different, right? Like, how did it feel in that change?
It was just a huge culture shock.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Which, and look, it's a culture shock to everybody. You know, I talk to a lot of first year law students. So I'm the director of academic success at the law school where I teach. And, you know, that's what a lot of students feel, no matter what discipline you're coming from. Nothing really prepares you for law school. And so it was just, it was, in many ways, it was just a slap in the face, right?
Okay.
I was not expecting what happened to me, right? Which is, you know, you can be a great student, you can be a great writer, you know, you can have friends who went to law school, but that doesn't mean that you know how to do law school. So I really had to just learn a lot about how to do law school and how to be a lawyer, because law school really is about trying to train you to, quote, think like a lawyer.
Yeah.
That's something I had to learn. And of course, everyone has to learn. I didn't like it. I really, really didn't like it. And I wanted to drop out. Within the first week, I felt
wow.
Like this is not for me. Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. I have memories of just walking around the city, talking on the phone with my parents, crying, like, I just don't want to do this. I did apply to a couple of linguistics programs in the middle of my first year of law school.
Incredible. I'm just, thank you for sharing all this. This is amazing. And now, of course, like, the next step, but you stayed, right? You stayed.
I did stay. And I think, you know, everything worked out really well. And I'm glad that I stayed. Ultimately, I didn't end up applying to the one PhD program that I really wanted to apply to. And that was Georgetown. Mm-hmm. And the only reason I didn't apply to that program my first semester of law school is because their application deadline was earlier than any of the other schools. And it was right in the middle of finals. And I just couldn't get my act together. But I'm so glad that happened, because as a result, you know, I got into the other schools. They weren't my top choice. So I thought, you know what, law school is only 3 years, two more years. I'm really going to give it a shot. Maybe I will end up falling in love with it. Maybe I will want to be a lawyer. I'm just going to see this through. And if I still don't want to do this, if it's still not for me, then I can, you know, get my PhD in linguistics. Mm-hmm. The other thing I should mention, and within my, you know, again, within the first couple of weeks of law school and my first year and then, you know, beyond, I was very interested in how law was taught, especially because I had that background in teaching already. You know, there were a lot of things that I was very critical of, and a lot of things that I didn't really understand at the time, but that I really started understanding as time went on and as I spent more time in law school. And I was so intrigued by that. And I thought, well, I actually do want to study this. And I think I did end up doing some, you know, linguistic stuff on the side while I was in law school. And I think that's how I started learning more about sociolinguistics and, you know, that you can study interactions. And maybe I could study the interactions that take place in law school and how do they socialize students into the legal profession? How might they hinder student socialization? How do they help? How do they hurt, et cetera? And so I was really interested in that. And so I really kind of that's how I sort of developed my research focus that I ended up pursuing in my PhD.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. It seems like having some linguistics training, some background would be really helpful in law school. I know other undergrad degrees would be too, but because law is all about language, right? Like that's who the experts are linguists. So being able to look at it from a linguistic point of view, like you were just talking about, kind of analyzing it and doing it more as research, I think it's a really good pairing in that way.
Yes, it is. I didn't really, it's hard for me to remember because it was a while ago. I don't remember my linguistics training being as helpful at that time, but I think that's because I just didn't have that much training and I didn't have the kind of training, you know, in sociolinguistics in particular, that I then got in my PhD. So now, you know, having that training and being in a law school, there's a lot more things that I'm noticing. And, you know, that training can really inform the way that I teach and, you know, just everything and how in the curriculum, right? In the syllabus that in the way that I teach, you know, legal writing and legal analysis. But at the time that I was in law school, I didn't really see it yet.
Yeah. Yes. Well, you were in it. You were right in it. Yeah. And, you know, you were busy trying to finish school and not go insane. So you finished the degree and then it sounds like you were really set on doing that PhD by the time you got through law school. Is that right?
I was, yes. I made a decision in my second year of law school. So I don't know if you know this, but in law school, you know, you have to be very deliberate and intentional about like every step of your kind of setting up your career. So, you know, after your first year of law school, you should do ideally some kind of internship. After your second year, if you want to go into big law or work at a law firm, then it would be really nice to get a summer job there after your second year. And then they might give you an offer to work there, you know, full time after you graduate. And there's just like all sorts of things you, quote, should be doing when you're in law school, right? You should be on a journal. You should do a clinic. You should do there's just all these things that you should do. And in my second year, I decided, well, I don't want to do all those things because I don't think I want to be a lawyer. That was a very conscious decision I had to make that actually I'm not going to do this early interview week where you talk to all these different employers, although I think I actually did end up doing one interview. But I decided I don't want to get a summer job after my second year at a law firm. I would like to teach English. and that was when I made that decision that, okay, the PhD is the route that I'm taking. I'm finishing this law thing, but I'm going to do a PhD.
Yeah. Were you working teaching English the whole time you were in law school or were you just focusing on school?
I was, so not in my first year. And that's not because I didn't try. I did want to. So in your first year of law school, your schedule is set. You have, you know, you have no power over kind of what classes you take and when. And I remember there was a class that I really wanted to teach. So I was an adjunct at NYU and the New School, which are both very close to where my law school was. I went to Cardozo. And I wanted to teach a class at NYU that met, I don't remember when, but it conflicted with one of the classes I was supposed to take my first year. And so I remember writing to, I think, the dean of students or somebody. And I said, you know, I want to teach this class. Just it only meets, you know, 4 hours a week. Can you change my schedule? around. Could you put me in a different section? And they were like, absolutely not. You cannot teach.
Jeez, okay.
Okay. And look, I get it. I totally understand why not. I mean, I tell students as well, if you can avoid it, please don't work in your first year, or, you know, well, especially your first year. So I didn't teach my first year. My second and third years, I did. And again, it was so convenient because my law school was, I don't know if you're familiar with New York, but it was on 5th Avenue and 12th Street. And then one block down on 12th Street was where I taught at the new school. So I would teach a class in the morning and then I would go to my classes. Mm-hmm. And that was, it was really, really nice.
Yeah, that sounds great. How nice not to have to commute all the way across Manhattan, which is often
yes.
the case.
Yes.
Okay. So you're doing this, you made this decision, you applied to Georgetown and you got in. Congratulations on that.
Yeah, thanks.
And so at that point, entering your PhD program, you mentioned before that you had a pretty good idea of what you wanted to do for your research. So what was that? What did you do?
Yeah. So I ended up doing exactly what I wanted to do, right? What I set out to do, which I don't think happens that often, right? I mean, you go into a PhD program thinking, I want to study XYZ, but then, you know, you learn all these interesting things and you kind of, change your focus a little bit, which is normal and I think great. I just ended up really studying what I set out to study, which was just what happens in law school, just the language of law school and those classroom interactions. Now, it was a little different. It was a little different from what I set out to do because in my mind, I was interested in kind of the traditional law class, like the JD class, which is the three-year program, right, that I went through. What I ended up doing was on an LLM program, which is a Master's of Law. Mm-hmm. Program, which is a postgraduate law degree. So it's for students who already have a law degree, a JD, right? If you went to school in the United States, or if you have a law degree from, another country. And so typically, foreign trained students end up getting an LLM. And I ended up doing my dissertation research on the LLM program because I happened to teach in the LLM program. So it was kind of a great way to combine two things that I was doing.
Mm, okay. That's great. It's so interesting. You know, you went in with this very specific idea and you were able to do it like exactly what you wanted to.
Yeah.
That's extremely cool. And so, you know, you've been talking about how much you enjoy teaching. Where did you think you were going to teach when you finished your PhD? What was the plan?
Well, the plan was to be a linguistics professor.
Okay.
I didn't know where, but I thought I was going to teach linguistics somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But then, your life changes when you meet different people. And so one of the people that I met very early on in my PhD, in fact, I want to say within the first 2 weeks, I took a class called Forensic Linguistics with Natalie Schilling.
Mm-hmm.
And she invited a guest speaker from the law school, a professor at the law school who recently retired, Craig Hoffman. And he gave a guest lecture on just the U.S. legal system. And, you know, I went up to him at the end and I told him my story and that, you know, I had a law degree and, you know, all the stuff I've kind of shared with you. And so we kept in touch. And then in my second year or my third year, I think my third year in the PhD, I ended up, he hired me to teach at the law school in one of the LLM programs, it's called the 2-year LLM program, and the first year of the program is designed to help students, foreign trained students, really learn legal English, so that they are prepared to take those, all those law classes that they have to take as part of the LLM, and so.
So he hired me to teach as an adjunct in the program and to teach one of these legal English classes. And then, you know, I taught that class, and then there was a fellow program that opened up. So then I could become a fellow there for 2 years and teach full time in the program. And so that really changed the course, right, that I was taking from linguistics to more law, because now I was at the law school and I was teaching there full time, and, you know, ended up doing my dissertation research there. And then, you know, right time, right place, my supervisor, she ended up moving. And so moving to another state, and then I ended up becoming the faculty director of this program right after I graduated.
Wow.
Because I love the program. And so again, that was not the plan when I went to get my PhD, but it's kind of where I wound up.
Yeah, well, it's a perfect Venn diagram, shall we say, of your interests and your experiences. And also, as we say with everybody we talk to, you know, the opportunity was there because of the networking that you did, because you were meeting people, they knew who you were, and you were the right person at the right time for that particular position that opened up.
That's absolutely right. And I think the networking piece was really important, right, that I ended up talking to Professor Hoffman, and he really did, you know, that decision to talk to him, to stay in touch with him, really did change my life in pretty significant ways.
Yeah. That's so fantastic. So you were there for, I'm looking at your LinkedIn profile, for 6 years, right? Doing these things.
Yes.
And you were drawing on your experience and everything you're teaching. Was there a point where you thought, I'd like to be in a different place or do something different? What prompted the change?
Well, you know, a lot of it was, now we're kind of in the pandemic, 2020. And I actually lived in, you know, I moved to Baltimore about 10 years ago. So I was commuting to Georgetown for 6 years. And we ended up buying a house a little bit, you know, in the northern part of Baltimore, technically in Towson. And so, but again, this was during the pandemic when we had the 1 year of Zoom school. And so that was fine. But then at some point it dawned on me, I'm going to have to keep commuting back to Georgetown. Go back to school in person. And that thought kind of scared me. So I ended up, trying to find a job here in Baltimore instead.
The process was, the current position you have has a great title. I love this: Professor of the Practice and Director of Academic Success. Great. At the School of Law. Was that through networking that you found that particular position?
It was not. I actually knew nobody at the law school. I was looking for a job here in Baltimore, and that one seemed like it would be a really great fit. And in fact, it has been a wonderful fit for me. I was just so lucky, you know, that it popped up when it did, and I applied for it.
Yeah. That's the other part of it, right? Is the networking is one way, but the other way is, as you're saying, like, you're looking, right? You're open to the possibilities. You're open to what might be out there. You're not just waiting for stuff to come in your lap. Like, you're doing some searching to find what there might be.
Oh, absolutely. I really wanted a job in Baltimore. I was definitely looking. But yes, of course, I got very lucky because I found a job that was a really good fit for me.
Yeah,
but I absolutely had to look actively, of course.
Yeah. For people, especially for people who are just coming out of graduate school, the job search is like a job, right? It's now your new part-time or full-time job is looking for a job.
Right. And by the way, it wasn't the only job I applied to. I did apply to a couple of other positions as well.
Yeah.
I'm really glad that I ended up going with this.
Yeah. So let's find out, what do you do? Like, what's your job? What responsibilities do you have?
Yeah. So, um, So I kind of wear two hats, the professor of the practice hat. So that is a faculty role. So I, in my role as faculty member, I teach two classes. Well, I should say I teach two sections of the same class, which is called Rules and Reasoning. And that is a legal reading, writing, analysis class. And it's for second year students who have a 2.8 GPA or below. So students who need a little bit more academic support. And that class, you know, I created that class from scratch, basically when I started here, but not really from scratch, because the framework that I used was the same framework that I used when I taught legal English at Georgetown. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, learning law is kind of like learning a new language, whether you're actually, you know, learning English as a second language and learning law, or whether, you know, you speak, you're a native speaker, but you're just learning law. And so I have used the same methods, not the same materials. I had to develop new materials, but really almost the exact same methods teaching my U.S. trained, mostly native speaking students, as I used with my foreign-trained, non-native speaking students.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah, it's actually really cool. Actually, I just wrote an article that will be published next year. I just wrote an article about using insights and approaches from second language pedagogy to teach legal analysis writing, which was really fun to do.
Yeah.
So that's the professor piece, the faculty piece. And then on the other hand, I'm also director of academic success. So that means I do all the academic success programming for the law school. And there are a variety of things involved with that. So I do orientation, something we call continuing orientation, which are workshops for all the first year students who come in, which is really about just introducing them to the various skills, basic fundamental skills that they need to do well in law school, from reading cases to briefing cases to outlining, synthesizing the information that you're learning to writing a legal analysis. Because most law students, most law school exams have essays, essay questions, I should say, which are based on a fact pattern. So you get a story, and that story contains facts that raise particular legal issues. And then, you know, the student's task is to resolve those issues using the rules that they've learned in class in an essay format. Mm-hmm. And we have a whole, you know, analytic framework that we use to do that called IRAC, Issue, Rule, Analysis, Conclusion. And so I teach students a lot of that stuff. I also do one-on-one meetings. I oversee all the peer support programs at the law school. There are three different such programs. I develop materials to help the students. There's a lot of work with that part of my job as well.
So you mentioned before that now that you're in your current position and have been doing that for a while, you see better how your linguistics is working into your current job. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I think a lot of what I see is, you know, I mentioned that article that I recently wrote, is how also just my teaching of ESL plays into what I do. And, you know, the things I've learned about just how people learn languages, you know, SLA, and what works to teach language, that I really do use on an almost daily basis. Well, maybe not a daily basis, but it has really informed my approach to developing my materials that I use in class, but also just how I teach, you know, how I interact with students, the kinds of questions that I ask, what I make explicit. What I've noticed is that I think second language pedagogy is just really, really good pedagogy. And what I've noticed is that, you know, explicitness is the gold standard in teaching language. And that's not really the case in teaching law. If you've ever talked to law students, they might use this term hiding the ball, right? This idea that, well, you know, we don't want to spoon feed you. So we kind of want you to figure stuff out, which I can get behind. But I think what happens is a lot of students are just really confused because there are so many things you have to learn in your first year, especially when it comes to legal writing. And so my approach is just to really kind of unpack everything and spell everything out, just as I did with my ESL students. So that has been probably the biggest thing. That's what I've really used mostly. In terms of my training, my PhD, I think some of the work that I did in my dissertation has really, and actually even during my PhD, so we had to do some qualifying papers. Some of that work actually I do use in my teaching as well. So if I can give an example, one example is I did a study on a law professor and teaching torts and just kind of looking at his language and how he asked the questions, but also how he sanctioned student responses, right? So how he responded to student contributions. And a lot of what he did was essentially after a student made a comment, he would frame it as an argument. So he would say something like, okay, so your argument is blah, blah, blah. Now your position is blah, blah, blah. And then sometimes he would place these students in dialogic opposition. So he would say, your argument was this, but what do you think? Your argument was this. And then it would create these identities, I think, for students as people who make arguments, as lawyers who make arguments and who take positions. And that is something that I do in my own teaching now. So when a student makes a contribution in class, when we're going over some kind of hypothetical, I always like to frame it as an argument to, again, kind of position the students as advocates who would make arguments on behalf of their clients. And that really comes out of work that I did in my PhD. My dissertation too, another thing that I did in my dissertation, one part of my dissertation was I analyzed my colleagues. So when I taught in the 2-year LLM program as a fellow, which is what my dissertation research is on, I co-taught this legal English class with a colleague. And the colleague, she had a PhD in linguistics. And, I was working on my PhD, but I also had the law degree. So this co-teaching model, right, assumes that you have a kind of a subject matter expert and then, someone who knows the language. Mm-hmm. piece. And so, she taught the classes on writing, and she would do this really interesting thing where she would construct the dialogue of a reader and a writer. So I don't know if I can remember any examples, but she would, and often it was like internal dialogue, right? So the reader is thinking this, they're reading this and thinking, oh my gosh, what a great point. Or the writer is saying, well, I really want my reader to. So anyway, she was kind of animating reader and writer. And I realized she was doing that to really show that writing was this this kind of social endeavor, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Where a reader and writer are actually talking to each other.
Right, yes.
And it really increased the student's sensitivity towards their readers. And she just did such an expert job at that. And I do some of that, I think, in my own teaching now too, in teaching writing, is that I really try to give voice to that reader mm-hmm. a lot.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I see that phrase, come up a lot in talking about the way that we look at texts or any kind of text, right? Instructional texts or things that you read for enjoyment, is that the writer and the reader are always in dialogue, right? And that's exactly what you're talking about. And again, thinking of it from a linguistic perspective, of course it's that way because that's what you're writing for, is for someone to read it, right? Mm-hmm. Even if it's yourself, right? You're writing for something, for someone, and that could be you're writing for yourself, but then you play both parts, but it's never sort of writing just to put it out there and never have anybody read it, because then there's no point to it. It's all about communication.
Right. Absolutely. And I take that really seriously. Yeah. You know, my students do a lot of writing, and I read everything they write and I give them feedback, you know, in little bubble comments. And I really view that as a conversation that I'm having with them. Mm-hmm. You know, we've been talking recently about, you know, possibly using AI tools to help give feedback on student writing. And I am getting a little more resistant to that because even though, you know, that would be really helpful, right? I spend a lot of time reading my students' work and giving feedback. But I feel like just a big part of what I do and the way I connect with my students would just be erased, because that's how I engage in dialogue with them. Of course, I engage in dialogue with them in the classroom, but a lot of the work we do is through that written word. And so I wouldn't want to give that up.
Yeah, absolutely. The area of AI and LLMs, different LLM than what you were talking about before, you know, again, people should be talking to linguists about this and not tech bros or whoever, because linguists are the ones who are making these things and also who understand what they are and how they work and why they don't work, as you were just describing, in some circumstances, because it can never be a real dialogue, right? There's no intelligence or intent behind whatever the AI is spitting out. It's just, you know, statistically matching words to go there. I think people don't really understand that because the tendency is to anthropomorphize it and think like, oh yes, it is actually communicating. It's like, no, it's not actually communicating.
Right. And also to think about the ramifications for education, which I know, you know, we are thinking about it. We're thinking about it a lot. But I've just been really refining my stance on this just in the last couple of weeks, actually, where, yeah, I'm feeling a little bit less comfortable with it because I worry about it, you know, taking away what I love to do, right? Yeah, which is to interact with my students. And I just wouldn't want that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. I hadn't even thought until you started talking about it. I hadn't thought about the way that AI and LLMs come into your specific area. Like I have seen it being used and misused in creative writing classes and things like that, but law is so specific. And also there's also the reality that it's just going to make stuff up, right? We've already seen that with, I've been reading a lot about law firms in quotes saying, you know, there's an AI assistant that'll draft your contract for you. It's like, no, you can't do that. It doesn't work that way. You're not going to get what you think you're going to get.
Right. And it does make mistakes. And we do. Yes. We have lots of conversations in just law generally about this, certainly in legal academia, but it gets things wrong. Yeah. I mean, you know, I've heard of colleagues say that it just made up case names.
Yes.
So it sounds great, but you know, we can't really trust it, at least not yet. And also, you know, I know this isn't what we're really here to talk about, but I think it becomes an existential issue. And I just worry about that, you know, for me as a legal educator, for, you know, my students who are future lawyers as well.
No, absolutely. I mean, I agree with you. I think it is an existential issue, and it's important for linguists to pay attention to it and to have informed opinions about it, because again, we're the experts on language and people are going to come to us to ask what we think. And, you know, again, getting back to the reader-writer dialogue sort of thing, laws are only laws because human beings make them up, right? They're not there. Like they don't exist outside of society. And if you're allowing a non-human thing to start weighing in on this, it's going to go wrong because they're not humans. And even the interpretation of laws is completely subjective and dependent on context and all of that. And, you know, computers don't have that capacity. Only people have that capacity.
Right. That's absolutely right.
Yeah. So I agree with you 100% on this. Okay. So aside from the existential crisis that we're now facing, do you have linguistic students in law school? Do you get any of those?
I don't think I've ever had a linguistics student, although I recently found out that I have a colleague who minored in linguistics. I was very excited about. He said a couple things just a couple weeks ago. He said something about critical period. And then, you know, a couple minutes later, he said the word phoneme. And I'm like, you took a linguistics class, didn't you? And then, you know, he said that he had done a linguistics minor. But no, I don't think I've had any students.
Okay, that's interesting. I don't know what kind of percentage of, if we took law schools countrywide, there would be linguistics students. But people have asked about it, and people have asked about forensic linguistics as well, which is different from what you do, but, you know, adjacent. Do you think, just in your experience and your own personal journey, that if there are students who are getting their master's or whatever degree they're getting in linguistics, if they're interested in law, it would be a good choice for them?
I do. I actually think it's a really good choice. I actually do teach forensic linguistics at Georgetown. So I've taught it once. And it was interesting because a couple of students in that class were planning to pursue a law degree afterwards. And so I think that was a really good, it's going to be a great fit for them. I know one student who took the class wasn't interested in law school, but was interested in it after taking the class. Because there's a lot there. You know, I think forensic linguistics is a great area of linguistics to study. Whether or not you have a law degree, certainly if you have a law degree, it's you have potentially even more insights. But I like that pairing, right? I think the pairing of linguistics and law does make a lot of sense.
Oh, good. It's good to hear you say that. It's always been my impression that it has, but you've had the experience and you're in it right now. So I think that's very encouraging because I think I have heard from people, especially folks who are interested in forensic linguistics, that there's this desire to do good, right? So doing that kind of work, especially for folks who are doing it on behalf of, like, you know, the Innocence Project or something like that, there's this desire to bring some good into the world. It's not just a job, like your heart is calling you to do it because you want to right wrongs or you just want to represent justice. And that's part of law school too, I think. So it definitely, there's some passion and ethics behind it that, you know, are not in every profession. Sometimes you do a job because it's a job, but this feels like it goes a little bit deeper.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And look, I think that's what a lot of law is. I know you were speaking about linguistics, but I think that's what a lot of law is too. You know, a lot of students who end up going to law school, it's because they feel very strongly about something, right? And so I think that is one great thing about law school. I mean, that was one thing that I just didn't feel as much in law school. How I knew that maybe that wasn't the path for me because I felt that passion about teaching,
right?
So, you know, that's how I knew that was for me. And so when I meet with students. Because I do, you know, I do mostly academic success advising, but inevitably, you know, we talk about careers as well. And I know this is idealistic, but, you know, I always tell students to think about, I mean, what is the thing that just really energizes you, that you feel really passionate about? If, you know, if you can do that, that's really, I think, worth striving for. You know, I know there's practical considerations, but if you can do something that you love and that you feel passionate about and you're helping others, that's great. Like that's what you should pursue, right?
Yeah, for sure. That's great. Those are great words of advice. And again, I'm just so pleased to hear you talking about this intersection of linguistics and law, because I think it's an area where linguists can not only thrive, but they're really needed, right? Like the experts on language in law, that's a great place to be. There's so much to offer from a linguistic training point of view in that whole area.
Yes, that's absolutely right. Now, I will say, I do think lawyers also think of themselves as experts in language. So I think sometimes there can be some hesitation there. But I think the linguists are definitely the experts. And so as much as, you know, there can be, I know it can be difficult, especially, you know, in cases to bring in an expert who is, you know, a linguistics expert. That can be difficult to do, but it is necessary.
Yeah. Oh, that's so good. So what do you think is in store for you? You know, you've got this great position. It's really well suited. Are you going to be there for a while, do you think?
Probably. Yeah, I like it. I've been doing it for almost 3.5 years now. Mm-hmm. I have some projects that I want to work on, in the program. I want to grow the Academic Success Program. There's a lot I still want to do. Mm-hmm. So yes, I will probably be doing this for a little while.
Yeah, and you're going to continue to teach at Georgetown, do you think?
Probably. So I will teach in the spring, this coming spring, which I'm very excited about. And if they'll have me, yes, I would love to keep teaching that class. It's really fun.
Oh, they would be foolish not to have you continue to do that.
unless they find someone who can do it full time. Sure.
Marta, this has been so great. Thank you so much for spending time with me. Is it okay if I put your LinkedIn link in the notes to this in case people want to contact you for questions or maybe informational interviews?
Yes, of course.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you for making yourself available to them. Again, this has been a delightful conversation. Thank you so much for spending time with me. I think the listeners are really going to enjoy this.
Thank you so much, Laurel, for having me.
Linguistics Career Launch is an ongoing nonprofit project currently led by volunteers that works to educate students, faculty, administrators, and industry employers about the value of linguists in business, government, nonprofit, and tech. The LCL has held 2 online boot camps during which attendees were able to learn from and interact with career linguists, as well as gain practical experience in career management skills. Videos of all our recorded sessions are available on our YouTube channel. You can get in touch at linguisticscareerlaunch@gmail.com.